Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Reed Brody, Special Counsel with Human Rights Watch, who assesses the importance of newly released documents which establish that the abuse of detainees held in Pentagon-run prisons abroad was much more widespread than initially reported. Journalist and author Linda Marsa, who examines the recent recall of drugs like Vioxx and the relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the FDA. And Marty Hayden, Legislative Director with Earth Justice, who discusses Bush administration forestry rules changes and what it will mean for the almost 200 million acres of forests now under federal control. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On Sunday, December the 26th, a gigantic undersea earthquake occurred off the coast of Indonesia. Considered the worst natural disaster in 40 years, the quake rated 8.9 on the Richter scale, and the resulting tsunami swallowed coastlines from Indonesia to Africa. Early estimates of the international death toll exceeded 52,000, including 27,000 deaths in Indonesia, more than 18,000 in Sri Lanka, and 4,100 in India. 12 Americans have also been reported killed in the tsunami. The death toll is still expected to rise as recovery efforts get underway, and the International Red Cross warns that the number of dead from possible outbreaks of cholera and other waterborne diseases could claim as many lives as the initial waves unless clean drinking water is made immediately available. In Bandar Aceh, Indonesia, government officials have closed off all access to relief workers, making disaster assistance all but impossible to carry out. The huge waves that batter the Indian coastline may have damaged a nuclear power plant in southern Tamil Nadu state. The Indian government said that both units of Kalpakkam power plant were safe but shut them down. Rising tides due to global warming have raised the sea level in India, which may have been a factor in the vast devastation of this latest natural disaster and contributed to a super cyclone that hit the coast of Orissa in 1999. Development of roads, shrimp farms, ribbon development along coasts and tourism are eroding natural defenses in Asia, according to the environmental group Greenpeace. World sea levels rose an average of 4 to 8 inches during the 20th century, and an additional rise of more than 2 feet is expected by the year 2100, according to the latest report by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Observers charge that failure to install a reliable warning system for earthquake-borne tsunamis, such as the one in the Pacific Basin, contributed to the vast numbers of casualties in this disaster. A huge red banner hung over the entrance to Renmin University in Beijing, greeting over 150 environmental organizations to a November 2003 meeting. Inside, eco-activists swarmed around a Western reporter to talk about the threat to damming the Nujiang River. The fate of the Nujiang soon attracted international focus. By April 2004, Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao put the huge dam project on hold. This was a major win for the emerging civil society movement in China. According to the New Internationalist magazine, debate over social and economic issues is thriving within the framework of the Chinese Communist Party. Yet, free speech has strict limits, with issues like the supremacy of the Communist Party and independence for regions like Tibet, Xinjiang, and Inner Mongolia strictly out of bounds. Western groups like Greenpeace, the World Wildlife Fund, Oxfam, and Doctors Without Borders are now all active in China. Urban Chinese have embraced the use of mobile phone technology to create alternative communities. Lesbian activist He Xiaopi says text messaging offers easy access to information while protecting the identity of gay and lesbian users in a hostile culture. In a landmark human rights settlement, the oil giant Unocal has agreed to pay damages to 14 Burmese villagers who were used as forced laborers on a company pipeline project. The oil company will also fund a program to improve the living conditions along the route of their $1.2 billion Yadana pipeline in Burma. The villagers had originally filed suit against Unocal in 1996, claiming the oil company was liable for acts of forced labor, rape and murder allegedly committed by Burmese soldiers during construction of the pipeline. The suit was filed using the 1789 Alien Torts Claims Act that has been cited in recent years by human rights groups to bring multinational firms to justice for abuse in their international operations. This is the first settlement amongst these cases, which could lead to more claims against major corporations. Last June, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the use of the torts law by foreign nationals against U.S.-based companies. In the December 13th initial settlement, terms were withheld by Unical and the plaintiff's lawyers, which included the group Earth Rights International. A final settlement is due by February 1, 2005. Although Unical denied any wrongdoing in the case, activists say an important point has been made. As Heidi Quanti of the Burmese Project told the Los Angeles Times, you would not settle if you did not think that you were guilty. Other big multinationals such as Chevron Texaco and the Ford Motor Company now face similar suits in American courts. As Seattle immigration lawyer Diane Butler explained to the Associated Press, corporations need to be mindful that they must be accountable for their overseas operations because the world is watching. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
In response to a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and other human rights groups, the government was forced to release thousands of pages of documents that established the abuse of detainees held in Pentagon-run prisons abroad was much more widespread than first admitted after news of the Abu Ghraib scandal broke last spring. The documents contain reports by FBI agents who describe techniques they saw systematically used by U.S. officials to abuse prisoners that included isolation, physical, and sensory assault. Accounts describe the use of stress positions, dogs to intimidate detainees, and exposure to extreme hot and cold temperatures. In one instance, a prisoner was seen shrouded by an Israeli flag while a strobe light flashed and loud music was blared into his cell. Some of the newly released documents allege that inhumane interrogation methods employed against prisoners in Iraq, Afghanistan, and at the U.S. Guantanamo Naval Base were authorized by President Bush and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, a charge that the White House continues to deny. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Reed Brody, special counsel with Human Rights Watch, who assesses the importance of these documents and understanding the use of torture in U.S. military prisons and who should be held accountable.
These documents, which I haven't read them all, but I've read many of them, what we see are really case upon case of abuse. We're seeing different agencies like the FBI, for instance, in email after email saying, hey, you know, what's going on in Guantanamo is no good. And we've got to stay out of it. We have our rules, and we're going to stick by those rules, and we're not going to get involved in any of this kind of abuse that the Defense Department is pulling off in Guantanamo and other places, because the FBI knows that that's not the way you get information from people. And they would go into Guantanamo and into Iraq, and they would see people, you know, being humiliated, being beaten, being mistreated. There are cases in which the FBI is complaining that they are finding detainees chained to the chairs, sitting in their own excrement, and they're upset about this. And one batch of the memos is all about that. There are other memos we see that suggest that the president himself may have issued an executive order to allow illegal interrogation techniques, and the White House has denied that such an executive order exists. But the FBI, in a very high-level memo, refers to it on 11 different occasions.
Reed Brody, you've assisted in the prosecutions of many human rights abusers, heads of state, Augusto Pinochet, the president of Chad, many others around the globe. When you look at the complicity of the higher-ups in this administration, in the Bush administration, including the president himself, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and others, do you see any vulnerability of these leaders to prosecution, war crimes prosecution in the near to distant future?
I certainly think that it warrants investigation. After the first pictures of Abu Ghraib came out, Secretary of State Colin Powell was confronted by leaders, Middle Eastern leaders in particular, at a conference in Jordan, and he said, watch America, watch how we deal with this, watch how America will do the right thing. The problem is that America hasn't done the right thing since then. In fact, the United States is doing what every banana republic and every dictatorship does when abuses are revealed. It's covering up and it's trying to shift the blame downwards. The United States and other and Human Rights Groups rightly call on countries like the Sudan and Russia to prosecute those who have committed crimes, not just the foot soldiers, but the people who are really behind the policy. And what is happening here is that even though it's clear and it is now incontrovertible that there are hundreds of abuse cases, that the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, himself approved illegal tactics such as the use of unmuzzled guard dogs to terrorize prisoners, hooding, keeping detainees in uncomfortable stress positions. Even though these tactics were also approved by Lieutenant General Sanchez, who was then the head top U.S. soldier in Iraq, and people under his command actually carried these out. All we've seen so far are very, very low-level prosecutions, people like Lindy England and Charles Grainer. Now, these people should be prosecuted, and what they did, even if they were ordered to do it, is inexcusable. But it wasn't Lindy England who cast aside the Geneva Conventions. It wasn't Lindy England who approved the use of guard dogs to scare prisoners. It wasn't Lindy England who counseled the President of the United States to get away with torture. If the United States wants to put the stain of this prisoner abuse behind it, if it wants to make a statement that this is not tolerable, it could be done so swiftly by saying, let's have an independent investigation. Whoever was involved in war crimes, whether it was a lower soldier or the Secretary of Defense, we're going to investigate that person and prosecute that person. The United States' reputation in the world would shoot up because we would be saying, you know something, this is wrong, and not only is it wrong, but we're going to do something about it.
The Congress is now controlled by the Republican Party. What has been their response to these allegations of torture, the documents that confirm the use of torture in U.S.-run prison facilities in Iraq and Cuba and other places?
We've seen a very, very tepid and timid response. The Senate Armed Services Committee, headed by Senator Warner of Virginia, held a number of important hearings in the aftermath of Abu Ghraib, but Senator Warner was under immense pressure from the Republican Party, particularly in the pre-electoral period, not to push it. And it looks unlikely that he's going to be pushing it now. Congress has really failed in its oversight here. And I think they've done a disservice to the American military and to human rights by essentially not pursuing this. And what we've been calling for, and other groups and many retired generals who are offended by this kind of conduct and the way that it's staining the reputation of the military, have called for an independent 9/11-style commission that wouldn't be beholden to one party or to one person. You know, there have been a number of people who've called for that. I don't see Republicans jumping onto that bandwagon at the moment. And Congress has really failed in its oversight here.
That was Reed Brody, Special Counsel with Human Rights Watch. Contact Human Rights Watch by calling area code 212-290-4700 or visit their website at www.hrw.org. Before its recall, the painkiller Vioxx had been used by more than 2 million people in more than 80 countries. But Merck & Company, the maker of Vioxx, withdrew the drug in September after studies confirmed earlier indications that the painkiller increased the risk of heart attack, stroke, and death. Since then, other drugs, including the painkiller Celebrex and the attention deficit disorder medicine Strattera, have come under scrutiny. But more importantly, confidence in the regulatory process, supervised by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, has been shaken. The FDA reports that adverse drug reactions among Americans have more than doubled from 1995 to 2003 and risen by more than fourfold since 1990. Questions have been raised about the standards used by the FDA in testing the safety of new drugs and about the regulatory agency's relationship with the pharmaceutical industry it monitors. The recent announcement by the drugmaker's top lobby group, Pharma, that its new president would be retiring 13-term Republican Congressman Billy Tozen of Louisiana, who chaired the House Energy and Commerce Committee, further raised alarm about the revolving door between government and industry. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author Linda Marsa, who examines the recall of drugs like Vioxx and the relationship between the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry.
We knew probably back in 2000 that there was a strong indication that there was a connection between heart attacks and death and Vioxx. And more recently, since the recall of Vioxx, there was another study that came out just in the past couple weeks that indicated that Celebrex, which is also belongs to the same class of painkillers as Vioxx, might have problems. And then earlier, Bextra, which is also what's known as a COX-2 inhibitor, might have problems. And, you know, again, Strattera, which is a drug for ADHD, which is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and it turned out that a couple people, it was just two, but two is too many, had problems with liver disease and I believe died from liver damage. And so that's sort of like the micro. But the macro is that this points up to a much larger problem with the drug supply. I think that, you know, people are sort of lulled into this false sense of security that, you know, everything is approved by the FDA and that, you know, at the Food and Drug Administration, you know, you have people that are watching these radar screens, you know, like air traffic controllers, and when a blip comes up, they, you know, dispatch a squad of people to investigate, you know, and nip things in the bud. And actually quite the opposite is the case, you know, and I think that that's really what's going on is that the problems with Vioxx and also with Celebrex and Bextra and Strattera really point up serious weaknesses within the drug safety net.
What specifically do you think is the problem? Is it the industry relationship with the FDA and the government regulators that creates openings for drugs that shouldn't find their way onto the shelves until more methodical and long-term testing is done?
The problem is that at every checkpoint in the pipeline, there's problems. You know, starting with the testing of drugs, okay? You know, we don't have, you know, government-funded research testing drugs, you know, because it's very expensive to test drugs, so the drug companies test their own drugs. So right away, you know, you've got a conflict of interest there. This came out with the, you know, with the recent stuff about 6 months ago with the SSRI antidepressants, Prozac, Paxil. You know, it was discovered that a lot of studies that showed some really serious adverse reactions were just buried by the drug companies, and they are under no obligation to reveal any of this. So that's one part of the problem. Another part of the problem is that when you're testing a drug, it's impossible to test it on millions of people. So normally, you know, a drug is tested on maybe 3,000, 4,000, possibly 5,000 people just to see how they react. And once a drug hits the market, you suddenly have 3 million people taking the drug, so that an adverse reaction that might show up in 1 in 1,000 people, suddenly you have a couple thousand people having this type of adverse reaction. So that's another problem. People know, you know, professionals who watch the industry, people in the FDA know really, truly, that the first year a drug is on the market is essentially a therapeutic experiment because, you know, it's like the first model year of a car. You know, you're suddenly going to have all these kinks that emerge that didn't emerge in the product testing.
Well, Linda Marsa, I know you've given this some thought. If you were to recommend reforms to the FDA and the whole regulatory system for pharmaceutical drugs, what would be some of the most important things that you would change?
Okay, well, the first thing, and this is not my idea. This is the idea of far greater minds than mine, and it's Raymond Wusley, dean of the medical school at the University of Arizona, very eminent Alastair Wood, you know, at Vanderbilt University, and a couple other people whose names I've left out. But they have been calling for the establishment of an independent drug safety board along the lines of the National Transportation Safety Commission to investigate. You know, right now we have a system where if you have an adverse reaction to a drug, you know, you report it to the FDA's MedWatch system. It's all purely voluntary. A lot of times it's just pure happenstance that an anomaly with a drug or an adverse drug reaction is picked up. There has to be a much more systematic way of, you know, reporting adverse drug reactions. I mean, that's the first thing. You know, the second thing is, along the lines of the National Transportation Safety Board, when problems like Vioxx happen or when problems like Fen-Phen happen, this should be investigated the way air disasters are investigated, you know, or the way the shuttle disaster was investigated. You know, do a real grim autopsy of the entire system to see where the breakdowns occurred in order to repair it, rather than letting all these crazy things go on. You know, and the third thing is that consumers themselves have got to be more vigilant. Don't get seduced by this direct-to-consumer advertising. If a drug is new on the market, that doesn't necessarily mean it's better. You know, you should really, if you want to take a new drug or something that's recently been approved, you should really discuss it very thoroughly with your physician. You know, the rule of thumb is wait till a drug has been on the market 3 years. Well, now, 4 years, 5 years before you're even going to use it, because it's within the first few years, usually, the problems will crop up. So that's something that consumers can do themselves.
That was journalist and author Linda Marsa. Her article, Sleep for Sale, can be read online at www.motherjones.com. Marsa's 1997 book about the pharmaceutical industry, Prescription for Profits, is published by Scribner. True to form, the Bush administration picked the run-up to a major holiday to announce a radical change in environmental policy. This time, the holiday was Christmas, and the issue is national forest management policy. The stated goal of the change is to increase efficiency and give more decision-making power to local and regional forest managers when creating 15-year plans for managing the nation's forests. The changes will make it easier for these forest managers to decide whether to allow more logging, drilling, or off-road vehicle use in the nation's 155 national forests and grasslands. However, environmentalists say the changes will lead to greatly reduced protections for all species who live in the forests and cut back on opportunities for public comment. Although the rules go into effect on December 31st, environmental groups are gearing up to challenge them. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Marty Hayden, legislative director with Earth Justice, an organization that litigates on behalf of environmental groups. He discusses what the rule changes will mean for the almost 200 million acres of forests now under federal control.
These are the rules that govern the management of all our national forests. They're responsible for the long-term management plans that last 15 years for each national forest. You can think of them of how they zone the forest, what areas will be open to logging, what areas will be open to mining, what areas will be open to off-road vehicles, what areas will be protected, what will be done to protect sensitive fish and wildlife, what will be done to provide, you know, adequate fish and wildlife, adequate game species, and to hold up the viable populations of huntable and fishable species for sportsmen. And what the administration has adopted here is a radical departure from every previous forest planning rule that has existed. They have gotten rid of Ronald Reagan's wildlife conservation standards. They decided that Ronald Reagan is too far to the left for this administration. It's known as the Wildlife Viability Standard, and it's the most important wildlife conservation measure that exists before it's a species ends up on the brink on the as being listed on the Endangered Species Act. But that those wildlife conservation measures apply not just to species at risk, but also to things like deer and turkey and trout. The other thing I think is important to know here is that for all practical purposes, these rules have eliminated the National Environmental Policy Act's application to forest planning. And that's something that has been in place ever since the very first forest planning regs were adopted, again, under the Reagan administration. The effect of that isn't just looking at what impacts occur environmentally. It also is very fundamental to informing the public as to what's going on, and particularly, and this is really important, getting the agencies to think outside of the box and getting them to do something other than their way or the highway. One of the primary reasons Congress passed the National Environmental Policy Act was to get the agencies to take the blinders off and look at a full range of alternatives rather than just deciding their way is always the best way.
The other side of this, I guess, is about giving more local control to the regional managers that oversee these specific forests. Some of them have complained about gridlock, that they couldn't get anything done because the rules that were in effect allowed so many opportunities for comment by all sides with an interest in forest management. Groups that wanted to use all-terrain vehicles or snowmobiles, on the one hand, groups that wanted to take out more, do more logging, groups that wanted to protect old-growth forests.
Well, the concern here is that they've eliminated most of the checks and balances and requirements, such as the wildlife conservation measures that have been in place for our national forests. The Forest Service is an agency that has quite a reputation of unaccountability. It's only in the last couple of years that they actually were able to clear an audit by the government relative to how they spent their money. They're right up there with the Defense Department in terms of having a hard time showing where the money's been spent. And we get very concerned over a situation where they have tried to give almost unlimited discretion to local managers relative to what happens on that forest without any real standards or requirements that have to be followed.
So are these rules final? Is there anything that can be done to change these or delay these or overturn these new rules?
These rules are final rules. These are what will be used for forest plans going forward. These new rules will go into effect before the end of the year, and they will remain in effect unless or until a court throws them out.
And do you think that'll happen?
I have high confidence that the environmental community will end up challenging this decision in court. I'm sure a number of our clients will be interested in challenging these new rules.
That was Marty Hayden, Legislative Director with Earth Justice. Call the group at area code 202-667-4500 or visit their website at www.earthjustice.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.